Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives. I have the tremendous zchus, privilege and an honor to have this next conversation with Rav Aryeh Leibowitz, who really needs no introduction, is very, very widely known for the many, many shirim and hashpa that he has in so many different ways, in psak and in a shul and in so many different forums. And it was really an honor for me to be able to send the book through a cousin of mine, who davens in a Leibowitz shul, to get a copy of the book and to make the contact and this connection. And Rav Leibowitz, thank you so much for making the time to have this conversation with me.
It's my absolute pleasure and honor to be with you. The book is fantastic. Your cousin's fantastic too. And I knew anything that comes with his recommendation. Chesky's just such a brilliant and sweet and sensitive person that I knew that that it would be good. But it beat my expectations. Really fantastic, fantastic work.
Thank you. So we're discussing chapter 6 of the book, which is called The Right One. It's actually, I asked Rav Leibowitz to choose a chapter he'd be interested in discussing. I was so happy you chose this chapter because it's a chapter that I'm very passionate about. And I also specifically wanted someone from a rabbinic, somebody with more of a Rav status and stature to speak to it, because I think it's something that for a lot of people can feel very therapist-y. And so to hear a therapist say it kind of almost loses some of the potency of it. So let me just quickly summarize, which is, or maybe that's just my own self-consciousness, I don't know. But let me quickly summarize the chapter. So there's these very well-known researchers, Drs. John and Julie Gottman. This piece of research is actually specifically from Dr. Julie Gottman. I had the opportunity to actually discuss this with them after the book came out. It was really a really neat conversation. What she found in her years and years of clinical work and research is that there are no predictive qualities to who is a good spouse for another person, who a person's relationship should be with by looking at character traits or qualities of personality. And that really the way to tell if somebody is right for you for a long-term, really deep relationship is to ask yourself the question of how do I feel about myself when I'm with this person? And that is the question that really has power. And what I suggest in this chapter is that we also can take that same framework and apply that to our relationship with Hashem. How do I know if I've found the real thing, the authentic Mesorah and tradition of Yiddishkeit? How do I know if I've really come into contact with Hashem? Is if I ask myself the question, how do I feel about myself when I'm with Hashem? And if the answer to that question is that I feel more alive, if I feel that I'm in the best version of myself, the highest actualized version of myself, then I have found Yiddishkeit that's real and I have found Hashem that's real. And if I haven't, then I need to still be looking. And we always need to still be looking, but I especially need to still be looking. So Rabbi Leibowitz, I'm really curious why this chapter is the one that you chose and what your reflections are on it.
Yeah, so first of all, not therapist-y at all. I think that it's everything you write is very strongly based in Mamari Chazal. It's strongly based in the teachings of various Gedolim and Tzadikim throughout the ages. So that part of what I love about the book is that it's so accessible, meaning I don't feel like you need to have a background in mental health to appreciate the value of the teachings. Now, the reason this chapter jumped out at me, I'm not sure what context it was. You were on some podcast. I don't remember which one. Do you remember?
The Inspiration for the Nation one. There was a clip of me talking about this specific Nakuda that got, I guess, more attention.
When you said it, like, I froze. I was like, meaning when you quoted the Gottman, I've heard a lot of things. I never really made it through any other books, but I heard a lot of things from John Gottman, and most of the things that I've heard are really spot on. But for some reason, I've never heard anyone quote this Nakuda before, and I felt so vindicated in a number of ways by this Nakuda. You know, I teach young men who are of marriageable age, who are either dating or have just gotten married. And a lot of times they come for advice in terms of navigating relationships, and particularly in the dating stage, the amount that I find that people in the dating stage get into the weeds of specifics. But can I marry someone who wears this kind of clothing? Can I like and like the details are like things that the guys themselves don't even know the words. They don't even understand what they're talking about half the time. They wouldn't know a stocking from a, you know, like they don't know what they're, but you know, the detail oriented types of questions. And I just like always say, like, take a step back. Like, a person is a lot more than one factor. Like, how do you get along? How do you feel like when you're with that person? And it to me, that was like, that's it. Like, to have the data to back that up, that how you feel about yourself when you are with the person being the number one factor in terms of, you know, in terms of predicting success of a relationship, I thought was fantastic. And also because my own friends make fun of me sometimes when I've been interviewed on also by Yaakov Langer, back when he was together with you know on The Meaningful People, together with Nachi Gordon. And one of their questions that they used to ask is, if you could sit down and talk to anybody for an hour in human history, who would it be? And my response immediately was that, like, I'm a shy person. I'm an introvert. I don't really love, you know, big rooms with lots of people and schmoozing. And I said, for sure, just like at home alone with my wife, just sitting and schmoozing. And my friends were like, oh, come on, you're just, you know, you're just saying that. But like, I think the mashal is more powerful than the nimshal almost. You know, you use the marriage as the mashal to the relationship with your Ribbono Shel Olam, but the mashal is not understood by so many people. Like, a lot of people don't, they don't live the mashal, and it's
Totally.
really, really important to live the mashal. So that's why it resonated with me. That's why I chose this
Yeah.
chapter.
By the way, it's interesting that you mentioned that you've seen a number of the different or heard, you know, different pieces of the Gottman's research. Because when I met with them, I sent them a copy of the book, and Baruch Hashem, they actually really enjoyed it. And then we had a Zoom conversation, the three of us, for about an hour. This was about a couple months ago. And well, you know, I was asking them, did I get things right in terms of the way I quoted things from you? And one of the things they said to me was that this piece of research, specifically this nugget, about, you know, the difference between looking at character traits versus how do I feel about myself when I'm with this person, again, is actually specifically Dr. Julie Gottman's contribution, was one of the pieces of their research that got the that has gotten the least attention, and it's one of the things that has been least kind of celebrated or spread. And yet we were talking about how of so many of the things that they've contributed, I think this is one of the most powerful, but it has not gotten a whole lot of attention.
I mean, I could, right. I only know that from my own experience, never having heard it anywhere else, and that you're publicizing it and bringing it to a whole new audience, who maybe would not have heard it otherwise, I think is huge, hugely important. So yeah, that's fantastic. That's really wonderful. So do you want me to maybe discuss some of the details
Yes,
in the
please.
chapter?
Yeah, or also just in terms of, you know, you mentioned that it's like the mashal and the nimshal. So meaning the mashal is the way that idea is used in terms of person to person relationships, particularly marriage, and the nimshal being the way that it's used between person to God relationship. And I'm curious also how you see that playing out in between us and Hashem.
Right. So maybe we'll start with the mashal, and then we'll
Sure.
go into
Yeah,
into the
absolutely.
nimshal. You know, starting with the mashal, you know, you have a line over here where you discuss, you know, around this one question is a cluster of related questions they're saying to reflect on. What does it feel like to be me when I'm with this person? In the company of this person, here's the line. Do I feel good about the person I am? Do I feel good in my own skin? And I think that the power of a strong and good relationship is could be summarized in that line, that it really brings out the best in you. that you become a better person when you're around this person. You know, you're a little younger than I am, so you're not at the stage in life where you start marrying off children, but we're right in that stage, right? Our oldest son is married, and thank God has we have a granddaughter. Someone said to me recently, we were at a simcha, and my son and daughter-in-law were at the simcha together with us. And a cousin of ours said, after we were schmoozing with my son a little bit, said, "Wow, he became such a mensch. He became such, like, he really, like, it's just so impressive." And I said, "He married a good woman." You know, like, it's so obvious that she just brings out the best in him. And that's what a good relationship can do. And of course, it's going to develop, it's going to build your own self-confidence when you realize that you're a better person around that person. So I think as a mashal, it's extraordinarily powerful as a mashal. Now, as a nimshal, also very powerful. I'm curious, though, if you don't mind me interviewing you for a moment. You know, the way you phrased it at the beginning was, how do you know you found the right one with a capital O, the real thing? How do you know you're in the right relationship? So I'm curious, like, why you phrased it as how you know you found the right one, as opposed to how do you know that you understand the one, or that you understand what a relationship with the one should be? Meaning, like, there's no right one and wrong one. There's just one, right?
I guess that's true, right? I guess maybe I don't know if I thought about it in terms of that being. I don't know that I thought about that distinction in the sense that yes, there is only actually one, but how do you know you've come into contact with him
Right,
versus come
or
into
that the
contact
way
with
you've come
some.
into contact with him is the right method of contact, or the right, you know, that you're navigating the relationship appropriately. Meaning, I would say, like, when someone is dating, they may have found the one, but if they're not speaking properly, you know, like, if they're not speaking with respect, or they're interacting with the person on a more juvenile level, you know, so then the relationship's not going to build. It's not going to develop the way it should develop. But if they're relating to the person as they ought to relate to the person, then the relationship has much more chances to develop. So it's not who the one is. The one is the one, right? It's just
I
about.
guess, I mean, maybe it would be like an interesting philosophical question. So, like, let's say, just to use a kind of cliche version of this, let's say somebody has a understanding of God as a very punishing, angry, let's just, oversimplify this example for a second. They have this understanding of God as this very punishing, very angry, very zealous kind of a God. And that's their perception of God. So, I mean, this is more of a philosophical nature, I guess. I don't know how much it matters practically, but would you say that that person has come into contact with God, with the One, but just that their perception of it and their method of coming into contact is wrong? Or would you say that that's actually not coming into contact with God? That's just coming into contact with some imagined, idea of something, but it's not actually the thing itself.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah, the way I was looking at it was that once you recognize that there is a creator and there is someone that controls the world and that put the world into place and that made you, and that, you know, so then you've contacted the one. If you're looking at him with a jaundiced eye and you're misunderstanding it, obviously none of us fully understand, but, you know, if you're not even using the right pathways through which human beings have the capacity to understand, so then, you know, your relationship's not going to develop the same way. But I think at the end of the day, as far as practicality is concerned, there's no real difference between what you're saying. I'll say it's just the first thing that jumped out at me when you said, like,
Yeah,
when
no,
it's
it's an interesting, I never thought about it. It's an interesting question.
just back to the mashal for a second. The idea that and it connects to the nimshal also, the idea that a positive relationship with another person is reflected in the sense that you become better around them and that you feel better about yourself. You know, I'm reminded of a vart I once heard from Rabbi Prero in Chicago. You know him?
You have Elisha
So
Pero, yeah.
Yeah, so it, oh, is that Rabbi Meir Simcha Shomer's Shever Brachos?
Yeah, it's his
So,
father-in-law, yeah.
Yeah, so he said at the Shavuot Brachos, a vart from that he heard from, I think it was from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been Rav Lichtenstein. I'm not sure. It was one of the Rav Aarons, where the Gemara says that when the Chumash tells us that a wife is an Ezer Kenegdo, that Chava is an Ezer Kenegdo, so the Gemara says Zocha Ezer. Lo zacha kenegdo, which we normally translate to mean that if you merit, then she will be a helpful person to you. And if lo zacha, if you don't merit, then you're going to be left with a miserable wife and she's always going to be fighting you at every turn. So he said, zacha sometimes means not just merit, it sometimes means that you are correct, that you are right. So he says, Zacha Ezer, to the perfect woman, the perfect match for a person, the perfect mate for a person is both of those things. That when you are Zacha, when you are correct and you're doing the right things, Ezer, she'll push you in that direction and she'll help do whatever she can to help you accomplish those things that you're meant to accomplish. And Lo Zacha, when you're wrong, and when you're putting your efforts in the wrong place and you're holding grudges and you do. Kenegdo, she'll be the one to be Kenegdo to protect you from the worst parts of yourself, and to use our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam in that same way. That to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Habel Tayer Mesayin Lo, person wants to be Metayer, person wants to do good things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should push him. Now the idea of a punishing God, we certainly do believe in Schar Va'Onesh. Hashem does punish. He punishes us when we are connected, when we make the wrong decisions in our lives. But that's not what he's hoping to do. He's not looking to punish us. He's looking to push us in the right direction. So that part of the mashal also, had a certain resonance with me also. I think like a certain emphasis probably just, for balance. Should probably be, and you do have this a little bit in the a little bit later in the chapter, and you make allusions to it earlier also, where you write that it's to be confident enough and motivated to expand beyond your comfort zone. Meaning the idea is not just to know that I love myself and that Hashem loves me and that everything is always good, which but it's to take that love that Hashem has for me and realize that that should be a motivating factor to strive for more. Ohev mitzvos lo yispa mitzvos, that a person who loves mitzvos and he loves avodas Hashem is just going to be hungry for more. Or the idea, let's say, where you speak about, modani lefanecha, that I realize even while my hands are still tameh, before I've even done netilas yadayim, I realize I'm here because Hashem wants me to be here. Part of that is also, and therefore Hashem has a mission for me to accomplish today.
Right.
Meaning that so like that sense of mission, I think, is an important, because a lot of times when people hear this very correct and resonant and powerful message of being comfortable that Hashem loves you, being comfortable that Hashem wants you to be where you are and to not view yourself in a negative light, and that Hashem, even regardless of what you did yesterday, Hashem loves you. People very often don't finish the sentence. I even had, a friend of mine, probably a mutual friend of ours, I would bet, Kovi Fleischman. Kovi?
Yeah.
So he sent me a video a while ago of Rav Moshe Weinberger talking about, this idea, which is, pretty much like the most central theme of Rav Weinberger's teachings, about Hashem loving you. And at the end of the end of the sentence was that and that means that we have an achrayus to live up to that love and to do more and to try to respond to that love in a powerful way. And he said, "Do you think I should put this out there, this video?" I said, "Oh, why not? It's great." He said, "I'm just afraid that once it gets out there, someone's going to cut out the second half and only post the first half." I said, "What are you talking about? Who cuts videos and is going to do that?" Literally within an hour of him sending it out, I had it forwarded to me from other places. "Look at this beautiful video from Rav Weinberger with only the first half and
Wow.
the second half." Meaning, it's people love to hear that no matter what you do, Hashem loves you, because that But if you use that as a license to do whatever the heck you darn please, you know, that's not a good thing. Meaning we have to, I like how you emphasized, particularly at the end of the chapter, and this is what should motivate us to expand our horizons, to go beyond our comfort zone, to do more, to do better, to reciprocate, you know, that love. I just heard in a shiur from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, he said that the day after his wedding, he had his father pick him up. His father picked him up from his apartment to bring him to Shacharis, to go to davening, because he can't go out without a shomer. So his father picked him up. His father was a Holocaust survivor. His father was a person who saw a lot of tzaros in his life. He had lost a child, really a lot of tzaros. And he said that they were at davening together, and he sees his father's putting on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. And he said to his father, "When did you start putting on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin?" So his father said, "Today, I was zochel to marry off a son. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me such a matana. I'm not going to do something in return. I
Wow.
have to," meaning that love Hashem just showed me demands that I do something concrete going forward to reciprocate that love. I think that's a major element of
Yeah.
the picture over here.
And I'm so happy that you're emphasizing that, because I think for whatever reasons, that's really a like a culturally wide, societally wide mistake that, at least it seems to me, that there's this sense that if I focus on self-acceptance, if I focus on Hashem loving me, whether we talk about it from a spiritual perspective, a religious perspective, or a psychological perspective, that any of these kinds of forms of that kind of positive messaging, then that leads to complacency. And that if I focus on a more critical message, then that leads to motivation. And it really, I think that the research, at least psychologically, really does not indicate that at all. It actually indicates, in many ways, the opposite. It's actually a little bit complex, but because this the criticism can certainly lead to motivation, but it usually leads to motivation at the cost of a lot of other important things in life. So the people who are motivated by overly critical messages can sometimes achieve a lot, but in a very, very narrow sense, when the rest of their life will actually be falling apart. But the idea that the positivity, and I think this is what I'm hearing you emphasize, that the positive messaging can and should and actually really does, when done correctly, does lead to more growth and motivation, I think is so important and often just misunderstood.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, you allude to this also, that there's more than allude to it, you say explicitly at the end of the chapter, that there's that a sense of happiness just has this spillover effect in every area of life. Meaning, if you start your day, let's say, with just feeling that you've accomplished something, you know, the most common example people give is exercise, right? If you start your day on the treadmill and you feel like, okay, I just ran a couple of miles, today's going to be a good day, you're going to eat better that day than you otherwise would
Right.
have. You're going to everything you do is going to be a little bit better. You start your day with a Seder Limud and with a good tefillah and with it just, you know, I just had this experience myself because after Pesach, I decided, okay, back to the treadmill. And I was being good about it from Pesach until Shavuos. And then, you know, I pulled a muscle in my leg. So that first day that I couldn't go on the treadmill, I had the lousiest day, you know, when you don't get to start off in that way, so you feel like, oh, now everything's going to be bad today. Meaning it really, you know, it feeds itself. We need the small wins and that just genuine sense of happiness to motivate us throughout the day.
The simplest example I always just like to give people when they challenge this idea that the happiness or positivity will breed motivation is I don't know if I'm eating is you know if I'm eating a steak that I think is delicious and I have a bite and it's delicious, that doesn't make me not want to continue eating.
Right,
Quite the
exactly.
opposite. That makes me want to eat more to the point where I'll overeat, right? When something is good and it feels good and it's delicious, we want more of it. So if I feel good about having done something positive and I don't criticize myself for it or find the way that it wasn't good enough or that it didn't meet some expectation, but I actually allow myself to feel good about it, that's going to motivate me to want to push myself to have more of those experiences, I think.
Yeah, and going back to the mashal of the human relationships, being a positive person, just in general, will do more for your relationship than any other particular character trait. You could be brilliant, you could be witty, you could be funny, you could just being a positive person. You come into your house at the, after a long day with a big smile on your face. How was your day today? It was great. Again, quoting Rabbi Reisman from Tarav Das, he says that I brought my Talmidim from YU to Tarav Das a few weeks ago to meet with Rabbi Reisman, and at the end he said, you guys are all at the age where you're either just got married or are getting married, or in that parsha. When you come home after a long day, just everything was great. Big smile on your face. Later after dinner, you could break it to her that you need a new car because of the accident that you got into, or whatever. But like, it has to be with that sense of positivity, to know how to smile and how to, not sweat the small stuff, and to and that will impact your whole relationship. And again, it fits perfectly into the nimshel.
Yeah. So it seems to me that, at least this is my anecdotal experience, it is not coming from any kind of research or anything like that, but it feels to me very often like the culture in our frum circles is that there's almost like a street credit, that a person gets by kind of putting themselves down in terms of their frumkeit, of like where they're holding or what they've done. Like in Olamei Yeshivos, so like when somebody is still, primarily in learning, or they're a Baal HaBos trying to learn, and it's, to talk positively. I mean, I'm not advocating for talking overly positively in a way that would be kind of like arrogant or egotistical, but there's kind of like a culture of just, at least it feels to me, there's like a culture of formulating my own religious life with a very kind of self-critical tone to it. I don't know if you agree with that observation. Do you think that there's something good about that? Do you think that's something we want to try and change?
I think that in general, there's always been, two schools of Musar. There's the Godless HaAdam Slabodka, and then there's Nevardik, and there's, it used to be, whether human nature has changed or whether just our opportunities outside of our from communities have changed, and therefore negativity will just drive people away, whether we're more sensitive, whatever the issue is. But it seems that it used to be a very effective method, to motivate people by lowering oneself as much as possible. It doesn't seem that in our generation people react well to that. Meaning, even like the great Litvisha Rashi Yeshiva, it was part of the culture that if you said a bad svara, they would just yell at you. Like, it was that people in Rav Soloveitchik's shir before his year of Triple Avelos, when supposedly he mellowed a lot, he would, if you said a bad svara, ah, shikr, he would call people a drunkard, and because that's how you said good morning in Lita. That was the way people motivated each other. And at the same time, we also have to realize that anivus is a very, very high value in Judaism. One could argue that, according to most of the Baalei Mussar, it is the most important midah for a person to have. When the Orach HaTzaddikim goes through midah by midah, he starts with gaiva and anivus, because that's the most critical midah to develop. So the question is, how to balance that sense of anivus and without being, a defeatist and someone who's always down on yourself to the point that you're not going to be able to accomplish. So that's tricky. The Gemara in Sota tells us in Daf Lamed Beis that a person should not flaunt their accomplishments, be aware of them, but not flaunt them. And the Gemara says, but your failures you should say out loud. And then the Gemara says, really? You should go around telling everyone about your averos and your failures? And the Gemara says, no, your tsaros, your challenges, your difficulties, so that people could daven for you, but not your failures. Meaning, tamei yikra, the Metzora lets everybody know so that they could daven for him, and that they could participate in being part of the solution for that person's problems. But it's an interesting hava amina and maskar in the Gemara, that the Gemara is a hava amina. The Gemara initially thinks that you should let your failures be known to other people. You should go around talking about it. And the Gemara says, no, you really shouldn't do that. It's probably not the way to go. So that like almost like struggles with this very point.
Yeah.
Another point that I was just switching topics for
yeah,
a moment,
please.
That jumped out at me in this chapter. You quoted from your grandfather with the joke about the zoo owner. Who's I don't know, how much should I explain? Do we assume that everyone who's listening read the chapter? Should I go through it before I make my comment?
Most of these I've been trying to assume people haven't read the book, so
okay, all right. So basically the joke goes that there was a guy, a zoo owner, didn't have enough money to buy a monkey, and he therefore paid one of the zoo workers to dress in a monkey suit and to pretend to be a monkey, and then he was doing a great job. And then one day he somehow tumbled and landed in the lion's cage, and the lion approaches him and he started to shriek. He was terrified. He was going to be eaten alive. And slowly the lion comes right up to him and whispers in his ear, "Quiet. If you don't stop screaming, you're going to blow both of our covers," meaning that the lion was also also really just a person in a suit. And you use that as a lesson that very often we're a bunch of people wearing monkey suits trying to impress lions that aren't really lions. They're just people wearing lion suits, meaning that a lot of the things that we do, a lot of the keeping up with the Joneses and things of that nature, nobody is really themselves. And, you know, in our innermost relationships, hopefully our relationship with God, and hopefully also our relationship with our spouses, we can just sort of let our hair down and just like be ourselves, and we can actually just be, as opposed to the way we are, you know, in the way we interact with society. So I found it interesting, because I think that it's very true. There's a lot of I don't know, it's maybe a little too cynical to call it a show that we put on, but you know, whether it be protocols, etiquette, things that we do for social norms that maybe aren't really a reflection of ourselves. At the same time, the flip side of that maybe I think is worth exploring is the value of that, meaning the value of having those social norms and those etiquette. And, you know, I don't, you know, when no one's around and I'm not going to be on a video call, I'm not wearing a tie, you know, or a white shirt or whatever. You know, at night when I'm just, you know, in my house alone, obviously I'm in much more casual clothing. But is there value in, like, you're going to a wedding, so you dress up,
right?
You're going to shul, and even in that relationship, that most comfortable relationship, there might be value in being completely yourself, being reserved for only the most intimate relationships, being completely vulnerable and completely yourself, without any sort of, without any outside pressures. That's reserved for your wife. That's reserved for your kids. I wonder if there's value in that. Like, if I was totally myself all the time, my wife would freak out. She'd be upset. I'd run out of the Kiddush every time. I would never schmooze with anybody because, you know, socially, I don't love it. I think you froze.
Are we back?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, sorry about that.
I don't know where you lost me, but
I lost you when you were talking about the value of that etiquette and how that can translate into even like back home when we're with that most intimate or comfortable person.
Right. So I was thinking, like, what occurred to me is that if I was always 100% myself, I probably wouldn't be as productive in the world, mm-hmm. and probably it would annoy my wife a little bit. Not in the sense that, you know, that she's not the only one that sees me fully as myself, but in the sense that, like, you got to behave yourself when you're in public. You have to, you know, yeah, you have to. If you're at the shul's kiddush and you're the rabbi of the shul, you need to socialize with people. You can't just run into a corner somewhere like you want to. You know, so I'd love to hear you elaborate on that, or if you disagree with that entirely.
No. I don't disagree with it at all. I think I agree with that. Maybe I'm just wondering if a way that we could formulate that it kind of still fits into this framework is that we have different parts of ourself, and so the idea being that the let's call it the rabbi part, that you know, wears the tahai and socializes at the kiddush and etc. It's not an inauthentic part. It is a part of yourself. And that's different still than the part that would just be the, you know, the figuratively speaking, letting the hair down part. And the idea being that we, to be authentically me, we actually need all those parts of ourself. So like, I like to think that pretty much all the quote unquote diagnoses in the DSM or within the world of mental health, even the more extreme ones, are all functions of the human condition. They're just more extreme versions that can become disordered. So let's say, you know, somebody has, you know, bipolar or schizophrenia or multiple personality disorder, things like that, where they show up in different settings or in different times in their life in ways that are completely split in their personality, like completely split, that one doesn't even know of the other and it's completely different and, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, etc. But we all have that to some degree, just that in a healthy version of that, in a ordered version, as opposed to the disordered version, in the ordered, healthy version of that, we kind of have a core, almost as if you like a container that is able to hold all of those things together in a way that it's that they're integrated with one another and that they're not completely split from one another, but that different aspects of ourself show up in different ways. And so there's the aspect of ourself that is just kind of letting go of all the other aspects. And that's the part that's kind of meant for that home experience when it's later at night and I can just, you know, take off the tie, et cetera, whatever it is for each person. But then we have parts of ourself that we also need to have activated and actualized, which are the giving the drasha, being on a podcast, you know, whatever it might be for different people. So I think it kind of still fits within in that rubric, and maybe I guess what I'm hearing you add is that the societal expectations or etiquettes, etc., can kind of help us to actualize some of those parts that really are important to actualize.
Yeah, meaning I think it was particularly within the frum community, a lot of our accomplishments and a lot of what keeps us in line and keeps us doing mitzvos and keeps us disciplined enough is that, you know, if I miss Shachris, the guy who sits next to me is going to say, oh, I missed you today. Where were you? You know, like there is a lot of that chevreshef that really we find that I find at least that with learning programs. The successful learning programs are the one that involve some subtle amount of peer pressure. I don't mean in a negative way. I mean in a completely positive way. But like you said, that's not a costume. That's allowing, you know, some part of you to express itself. And I also don't think it's so bad when we see only the better parts of other people. You know, a lot of times, if you'd see all the negativity, it would be very frustrating, and it wouldn't be so motivating necessarily. But when you get to see the good stuff, if it doesn't crush you and you don't feel unworthy, or you know, but it motivates you. You know, like there's a whole debate about like the art school biographies, right? Where they don't go through the struggles. Like there's a biography about a particular gadol, not written by art school, I think, about a particular gadol who got divorced at some stage in his life, and it didn't mention a word about his divorce. Like it was obviously a major event in his life. And it's, you know, so people criticize, like, why did they leave out those things? Now, while some of the struggles may be very inspiring in seeing how people overcame the struggles, I find the victories very inspiring also, meaning I think like emphasizing what made them great as opposed to what made them average, to be what I want to read about. I find it to be very inspiring to see that about people, but I understand both sides of that of that debate and how people will be motivated by different elements.
Or I guess the middle ground would be that the victory is inspiring when we see the victory in the context of actually being a matter of struggle, as opposed to, I guess, what can sometimes feel like it's a victory that just was, it was just an alley-oop for them. It doesn't look like much of a victory when.
Right. So I think all would agree that, a rags to riches kind of story, like in the Rav Gifter biography, it says that when he applied to MTA as a ninth grader, they put him in the lowest shiur, and he overheard someone in the office say, "What? Why are you putting him in the lowest shiur?" And they said, "Because we don't have anything lower," meaning, and that's where, and then he became Rav Gifter, so that I think all agree is inspiring, and that all agree is something that clearly overcoming a weaker kind of background. Where I'm very happy to not read about things that were not overcome, things that were just, struggles where there were just weaknesses. People sometimes have weaknesses, and I'd rather not read about the weaknesses. And there's a beautiful vart I heard from Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zichrono Levracha, once. I don't remember who he quoted, but the pasuk says, "Lo sasa lecha pesel v'chol tumuna, asher b'shamayim mimal v'asher ba'aretz mitachas," which literally means, "Don't make yourself into a, don't make for yourself rather a graven image, whether it be an image of the sun, the moon, the stars, asher b'shamayim mimal, or whether it be something down here on earth. You shouldn't have idols." But he had al derech drush, "Lo sasa lecha," don't make yourself into a pesel v'chol tumuna, into an image of somebody else. Don't try to be someone else. How then should you utilize other people in self-motivating and becoming the best you? Asher b'shamayim, when it comes to heavenly matters, when it comes to matters of ruchnius, look mima'al. Look at those who have achieved more, those who have done more with less, and use that as a motivator. Asher ba'aretz, and when it comes to earthly matters, when it comes to gashmius, when it comes to creature comforts and things of that nature, mitachas, look at those who make do with less and are still managed to find their happiness.
Yeah, I guess it really is kind of sometimes a difficult, a subtle or nuanced balance. Because I could say, like, for myself, I am a member of a shul here in Chicago where I feel that many of the guys, the chevra that I'm part of, are people who are really kovei itim and learn at a level and in a quantity and a seriousness that. That's a level sometimes above me, or that the dikduk and halacha, or the hakpada of being on time to minyan, etc., are things that at times I can feel self-conscious of, and in a way that I think is actually really good for me and really helpful. But if it's in a way of that, it's not a matter of being inspired by it, or a way of holding myself to where I think I should be, but it's more of trying to be kind of more self-critical in the sense of, why am I not like them? Well, I guess because even that question, it really depends on how you ask it. Like, it's a very subtle thing, right? Because, like, why am I not like them can be a very helpful question. But then why am I not like them can be a really devastating question, like a really damaging question. It's very subtle in how a person experiences it.
I mean, what this chapter emphasizes is to be you, and that's why I love it. I think it's such a critical message. And you touch upon it, which you mentioned before, about how people sometimes do use negative motivation, but usually, even when that leads to accomplishment, it's in a very narrow area. And I know people like this. I know people who are extraordinary professionally, and it's purely through negative motivation, and they struggle a lot with a lot of other things, a lot of other areas of life. And I think Dava Lichtenstein once said that thank God now people seek coaching and therapy and to help them through these things. He said that it used to be that if someone would say, "I see a therapist," they would say, "Oh, what's wrong with you?" He said, where he comes from now, he's the CEO of a large company. If someone says, "I don't have a therapist," they would say, "Well, what's wrong with you?" Meaning, dealing with those kinds of pressures and those kinds of stresses, it could lead to a very unhealthy kind of balance if you don't have something to balance you out.
I do have one or two more questions, but to make sure that I have a chance, is there anything else in that you had in mind that you wanted to highlight or share?
I really loved the quote from Rav Kook. I just want to read it because I think it's fantastic. Toward the end of the chapter, the more a person loves himself, the more the goodness within him will spread to everything, on all his surroundings, on the whole world, on all existence. The more one elevates his own worth internally and externally, so too the light and goodness will be elevated and strengthened in the world. Just that expansive nature of feeling good, I think, is so critical. And Ashrecha for for highlighting that.
Thank you. So one last question. I saw a rabbi psychologist once make the ha'ara, the observation, the insight that when it says in Pirkei Avos, Eizu Asher Sameach B'Chelko, which, and this relates to the conversation we've been weaving in and out of this whole time, Eizu Asher Sameach B'Chelko, who's the wealthy person, the one who is happy with their portion, that in typically we always hear that Maamar Chazal, that statement, in the context of, let's say, Musar Shmuz is talking about materialism, right? And the physical world, that a person should be happy with what they have, and that's real wealth. And that's what we want to, kind of work on. And his point was that the Mishnah there, at least overtly, doesn't seem to specify that that's only talking about the material chelek that a person has, the material portion a person has, but it's also referring to the spiritual portion that a person has. And he thinks it's essentially important that we apply that same exact kind of mindset and that specific Maamar Chazal, but everything that comes with it, to our Ruchnius as well as our Gashmius. I'm curious what you think about that way of looking at it.
Yeah, so I've been asked a similar question just last night at my son's high school graduation. One of the speakers, one of the students, said that in the last day of Machshava class of senior year, right at the end of class, one of the Talmidim asked if you're supposed to be Sameach Bechelko in Ruchnius. And if you are, then what's the point of doing anything if you're already Sameach Bechelko? And then the speaker said, and the bell rang and high school was over. And he would never have an answer to this question. But I think there's a difference between Sameach Bechelko and Mestapik B'Muat. Meaning, it's one can never be Mestapik B'Muat when it comes to Ruchnius. A person should never feel that he's arrived, that he's accomplished enough, that he's done enough. There's no word in Lashon HaKodesh for retirement, because there's no such concept. A person has to use every moment of life to try to be better and do more and accomplish. Sameach Bechelko, I do believe, though, applies to Ruchnius, in the sense that whatever you've accomplished is worthy of celebrating, meaning a small victory is also a victory. Kalev ben Yefuna is celebrated for standing up to the Meraglim and causing everyone to just stop with all the chaos and with the Meraglim, everyone following what the Meraglim are about to say. He failed. He stopped everyone from getting caught up in it for a half a second until they ignored him and then went back to being caught up in it. But that half a second is also valuable, meaning every small victory should be viewed as a victory. We can't only look at things as, an all or nothing attitude is could be very destructive. So I think it's important that we be Sameach B'Chelko. At the same time, never feel that we've accomplished all that needs to be accomplished.
Thank you. That's a really, really helpful clarifying distinction between those two phrases. Yeah, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for making this time to have this conversation with me and for looking at the book. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. You should just know I quoted the book last week in my shiur in yeshiva. And I had forgotten the name of the book. All the Talmidim knew it. They all they said it's a
Wow. Thank
fantastic
you.
work. So you're making an impact, and you should keep on doing so.
Thank God. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.